Welcome to What Should I Do With My Life? Figuring it out from those who seem to have it all figured out. I'm your host, Stephanie Horowitz. When's the last time you stopped and asked yourself, what am I doing with my life? Why am I doing this? Do I even like this? Join me as we hear the inspiring stories of real people to find out what they did and are doing with their lives. Are they satisfied? Would they have done anything differently? Maybe through these stories, we will figure out how to bring more meaning and passion in our day-to-day. Hi, everyone, and welcome to our very, very first episode. Thank you so much for joining me today. In this episode, we will be hearing an inspiring story of a paperboy turned executive editor, publisher, business owner, and award-winning journalist. Guys, we're talking about my dad. It's my first episode. I needed someone who would support me no matter what. I thought this would be the perfect starting point for this journey. So without further ado, you're going to be hearing from my inspirational, hardworking, smart, funny father, Arthur Horowitz. I hope you enjoy. Hi, Dad.
Hello, Stephanie.
How are you?
I am okay. I am okay in sunny Michigan.
Is it actually sunny there today? Are you pulling
actually,
my leg?
Actually, sunny and nice. No, it's been very nice for several weeks now.
So are you going to go outside for a walk today?
Oh, I did that already.
You are the first guest. As you know, as my dad, there have been many times that I've come to you saying, I don't know what I should be doing with my life, or I'm passionate about this, I'm not passionate about that. Trying to figure it out. I think a lot of my peers feel similarly, where they're not really sure what they should be doing and how they can find meaning in their day-to-day. In their work, and it might not even be in work. And obviously we know that not everyone is lucky enough to be able to choose what work they could be doing and how they live their lives and spend their days. But I really wanted to hear from you and talk a bit about how you got to where you are today, looking back a bit on what led you to, you know, on this journey, and let's just dive in. So can you just tell me in one sentence what you do?
I'd say that through a Jewish lens, I attempt to educate, inform, and connect people in an honorable way so they can uplift their community, Jewish and general, and enrich their own lives. That's really what this job that I've been doing entails.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, I guess looking back when you were my age, or if you were growing up in New Haven, Connecticut, did you ever think that you would be where you are today? 30,
no,
how
never.
Many years?
Never.
Never?
No.
So how about you share a bit about your journey and where you are now and what you've been up to now?
Right. Well, you know, basically for me, there were two tracks that were parallel for many years. One was, of course, being brought up in a Jewish household, in a, I'd say, a lower middle class household. A father who was born and lived his entire life in New Haven, Connecticut, married my mother, who was a Holocaust survivor who came, you know, to the United States virtually with the clothes on her back. And basically, by the time I was 12 years old, I already had an interest in newspapers and journalism because I had a paper route. I would get up 5:30 in the morning. My dad would be there helping me put rubber bands around newspapers. In rain or snow, sun or hail, whatever it is, I got on my bicycle and I had to serve, you know, perhaps 60 or 70 customers within about a hour and 15 minute period. They didn't care if I had a cold or the flu. They wanted their paper. They taught me at an early age things like customer service, dependability, because if you didn't do it, nobody else was going to do it. Also how to be a little merchant, how to get more people on your route to buy newspapers, not because it would earn you a prize, but because they would derive benefit or value, in this case, knowledge, information from it. But it was really, you know, through my experience at Hot Walking Horses and, you know, living in New Haven, there weren't too many places where you had horse stables. And yet there was one not far from where we live because the Yale University athletic fields were behind where we lived. And they actually had an armory and they had 20 or so polo ponies and they actually played polo. But what it did is it exposed me again to, you got to be dependable, you get rewarded if you work hard. But when I turned 16 years old, I asked the polo coach of the team for a job. Mm-hmm. Now, if he was an accountant, maybe I'd be an accountant right now. If he was a real estate developer, maybe I'd be a real estate developer right now. But he was the managing editor of the daily newspaper in New Haven. So what he did is he offered me an entry-level job, meaning I was a copy boy trainee, which means I took orders from the copy boy. Trust me, there's nothing lower on the organizational chart than that. And it was an opportunity for me to take something, because I was writing for my high school newspaper, I was writing sports, but it provided me with an avenue that in many ways is, you know, is a key reason why I ended up with the career that I did. So that's an example of, you can't plot out your life every single step of the way. There are things that happen that you don't even know where they're going to take you to. And yet as a 16-year-old, it was that experience that put me on the path to secular journalism, okay? Mm-hmm. Working at daily newspapers, covering City Hall, eventually being the editor-in-chief of my college newspaper at the University of Connecticut, deciding that I was on the wrong side of the business and that I really wanted to be on the business side of the newspaper business rather than on the journalism side. Mm-hmm. So I ended up
What made you realize that?
Yeah, I think the thing that made me realize that is when you were in a newsroom, if you were looking to grow and move upward, your path was based on going to another newspaper that had more circulation, more readership than the one that you had. Mm-hmm. So I saw a lot of very talented people who I worked with who went to larger newspapers in places like Philadelphia and Boston and Cleveland, Washington, D.C., those newspapers failed. This was back in the late 1970s when evening newspapers were failing. These papers all had significantly more readership than the New Haven Register. However, the soapbox, the platform on which journalists were standing at those publications collapsed. So I kind of decided I want to be on the side of the business that builds up the platform or the soapbox so that journalists can do their job and also do it in a way where they don't have to worry, unfortunately, as we see more and more these days, that regardless of how talented they are, you know, if the business is failing, then it goes under. So that was the pivot there. I started to go to night school for an MBA. I went for a couple of semesters. I really liked it. I went to the University of Connecticut for an MBA. Did well, surprisingly well for me in certain ways, I guess. And I had a professor there, again, another one of those things that you can't plan, who was a very capable and esteemed professor of organizational psychology, industrial psychology. And I had mentioned how I was aware of a full-time program at Yale that had just started not that long ago. And he said, I have a student who did this, who was learning for me at University of Connecticut, and she went to Yale School of Management. It's a wonderful place, a wonderful experience. Let me help you. Let me write a letter of recommendation. Let me have you talk to this particular person. It's something that based on the work that you do, you can handle you know, going into that program. So that's the only program I applied to. I didn't apply to 5 or 10 business schools or even 2. That was the only one I did, and I was fortunate enough to be accepted. Perhaps that example with that professor was another thing that, you know, by and large, maybe I carried with me, certainly not as much as some of my classmates, you know, who achieved, you know, global, you know, acclaim in their work. But the message was think bigger, mm-hmm. think bigger, bigger. Mm-hmm. So that's another, I think, message is, you know, not only can you not determine what your path is from day one, but especially at a younger age, think bigger, be a risk taker in that regard.
Until that conversation with that professor, was that something that your parents ever pushed you to do? I'm curious, when you were thinking about what you wanted to do in your career and your passion, if your parents' background affected that. You know, Baba, my grandma, and your mother was a Holocaust survivor, and we know what survivor guilt is. And I'm wondering how that affected you, motivated you, or...
My father was a very smart person. He would have been a great college professor. He ended up being in his family dry goods business, which was a small operation, and he never had the push from his parents. They held him back, actually. You know, only later in life did he complete his BA in accounting when he was like 50 years old is when he completed it. Sometimes when people are not pushed, they push others. My father was an encourager, not a pusher. And my mother, in an unsophisticated way, tried her best to push us, not always using the right motivational tools or techniques to do so. But then again, she too had a very limited worldview. I mean, her house, you know, might just as well have been her castle, because for somebody who came from nothing and brought nothing over, there's a sense of security. Some people who've been through the Holocaust, they know what it's like to have nothing, and they shoot for the stars in terms of what they do. And then there are others who know what it's like to have nothing and don't want to ever not have nothing, if I can use double negatives again. So, but they didn't have a broader vision, going to Hartford, you know, for a meal or an event would be like going to Antarctica. And by the way, Hartford was 35 miles from New Haven.
I like that analogy a lot, and I can see that.
So when I graduated, I started in 1980, graduated in 82, the economy was really, really bad back then. It was hard to find jobs, even coming out of you know, high level, you know, MBA or MBA type programs, and a lot of my focus was on New York City because that is the media capital, DC, Chicago, et cetera, and the opportunity came for me to go to Baltimore. They were looking for somebody where my experience almost fit the job description to a T. And in connecting with the senior VP of marketing and sales there, it was like, you know, come on down, we need to interview you.
What was your vision at this point? You were finishing your MBA. What kind of role were you hoping to have? Like, what was the next step?
First of all, for sure, the positions were not related to anything Jewish. So these were not New Haven Register type places, and they certainly weren't Detroit Jewish News type places. But the Baltimore Sun, again, opportunity presented itself. It was a business that was started in 1837, I believe, and descendants of the founders were still running the business up until about 2 years before I came to the Baltimore Sun. What they did for the first time is they hired a non-family member to run it. And my role was to, work on marketing, research, corporate planning, econometric modeling, to take the paper and their subsidiary businesses in a direction that the founding descendants of the founding family hadn't or couldn't.
Did you enjoy that job?
Yeah, it was challenging. It was enjoyable. But what ended up happening is, as usual in a large organization, there are office dynamics, and the general manager of the company was really the gatekeeper, and he was a capable person, was very good to me, but he was the definition of a micromanager, and everything that anybody did would sit on his desk for weeks because he couldn't bring himself to delegating certain responsibility. And what happened is it just kind of like put a plug, in the pipeline, and it became less enjoyable when the work you did, was not being acted on the way it had been previously. I became involved with the Jewish Community Center Board, became an officer actually at a very young age of the Jewish Community Center, was involved with their federation called the Associated on some committees. And it was there that I met a man who it turns out was the publisher of the Baltimore Jewish Times. Now, growing up in Connecticut, there was a weekly Jewish newspaper called the Jewish Ledger. It was, you would wrap fish in it, maybe. a bird would feel very comfortable, defacing it, but it was maybe 12 pages or 16 pages each week. And when Gina and I moved, my wife Gina and I, your mom, moved to Baltimore, we had a family friend from New Haven who lived there. And we asked, well, where do we live? We need to rent. And she said, I'll meet you at Fields Pharmacy in Pikesville. And inside Fields Pharmacy, she pointed to a stack of newspapers and it said Baltimore Jewish Times. And I had never seen anything quite like it. It was about 180 pages. It was a weekly, it was perfect bound. It was probably at the time, I didn't know it, the finest weekly publication, Jewish or secular, anywhere in the country. The editor had been a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize that year. Subsequent work also qualified as a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. It was like a Bible. And of course, that's where you found where to live. But I became aware that Jewish newspapers weren't just this little schleppy thing that a bird wouldn't poop on, that they were actually could be substantive Pulitzer Prize worthy endeavors, and also that they could be financially successful. So when I met the publisher of the Baltimore Jewish Times on a marketing committee of the Associated, we chatted a little bit. And after chatting, he said, I'd like you to come visit my office. I'd like to show you around. So we set up a meeting and he started to show me around, and we went to the lower level, and there's a meeting room and there's a conference table. And there may be five people around the conference table, maybe six. So the man, Chuck Berger is his name, knocked on the conference room door and said, I'm just showing, Arthur around, I wanted to introduce him to you. And I distinctly remember one of the people in the room looked at me and just flat out said, so why do you want to move to Detroit? And I said, well, actually, that's the first time I heard about anything regarding moving to Detroit. And I looked at Mr. Berger and he gave a shrug of his shoulders, like trapped you, at least listen to what they have to say. They bought a newspaper in Detroit about a year and a half ago. Their key management people were commuting on a biweekly basis, maybe, to Detroit. They said, why don't you come out and maybe you'll run it for us? So, I did a little bit of due diligence, and then it was a typical, November in 1985, Detroit weather-wise. So we did the tour and, went back to Detroit. Went back to Baltimore. And in December, I gave notice to the Baltimore Sun and started, getting re-indoctrinated at the Baltimore Jewish Times, going out to Detroit a bit, and moved there officially in May of 1986. And realizing that you can have a quality Jewish publication, that you can marry two things that up until that point I hadn't married, which was my Jewish upbringing and the Jewish influence on my life with my professional and career passion, and that was journalism.
So when did it become a passion? Was it first a job and then it became a passion? Or, you said you were writing on your high school newspaper, so clearly you were interested, right?
There are probably a couple of things that that made it from a job to a passion. One is the first story that I wrote where my name was on it. Mm-hmm. It's one thing if your name is on your student newspaper, schmata, rag, or whatever. But, to see your name on a story and to know that it was going into over 100,000 households, and just the feeling of, wow, this is my work. It's open for scrutiny to everybody. Mm-hmm. If I screw it up, everybody's going to know, or figuratively, everybody will know. But the feeling of being able to impact and be recognized in some way, in this case a byline, mm-hmm. for the impact you had was powerful. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, and it sounds almost like a cliche of sorts, because for those who ever saw the movie that came out a couple years ago with Meryl Streep as Katharine Graham called The Post, and it had to do with the publishing of the Pentagon Papers, there's a scene where they're deciding whether or not they're going to publish, because the Attorney General, everybody is, and their own lawyers for the Post are saying, don't do it. And when the phone call goes down to the press room and the message is, start the presses, the presses start running. The building starts vibrating. It really does. And you see the papers coming off the presses and going out into the trucks. And the feeling of not just writing a story where it's yours for better or worse, because if you're inaccurate, you're in trouble. And if you're controversial, you're going to get feedback, combined with the power, that feeling of the machinery that literally was going into motion to produce it, and that a variation of that machinery had been doing the same thing every day, since the beginning of the Republic, since Benjamin Franklin's time, not necessarily, with, power presses and whatever. And every time I get shivers, when I was watching the Post, when those presses started running, I started getting tears in my eyes. So it's maybe a little nostalgia given, what's been happening to print media, newspapers in particular, but it was that passion, that personal feeling, but also that you're doing good. This wasn't just, you're processing, driver's licenses at the Department of Motor Vehicles, or you're, tightening a widget on an assembly line. Nothing wrong with any of that. But this was something that it felt important. It felt rewarding. It's not a high-paying industry in general, so you don't do it for the money. And tying that in with literally the shaking of a building, the so-called power of the press at the time, was, I don't want to say intoxicating, because that has the wrong connotation, educate, influence, inform, engage, connect people. That's at the core of that. And the Jewish News for me provided the opportunity to take that secular passion and overlay it with a Jewish passion, in part, you know, I'm sure influenced by having a mother and also a mother-in-law who are Holocaust survivors, that, you know, something that helps the future of the Jewish people. So my job was essentially to run the Detroit Jewish News, to run the operation, to grow, you know, to grow its readership, to grow its advertising, to grow its impact in the community, to find talent, also to connect the Jewish News and by extension, the Jewish community with the broader non-Jewish world around it, in certainly in the Detroit metropolitan area. It grew in a way because I mentioned about Baltimore. Well, my, you know, Chuck Berger, who ended up being my partner as well, he wanted to grow. And not just grow the Detroit Jewish News, which we did, which I was able to do, but also to grow in other communities. So in 1989, we bought the Atlanta Jewish Times. We started newspapers in Palm Beach County, the Palm Beach Jewish Times and the Boca del Rey Jewish Times. We had a publication in Vancouver, British Columbia. We were growing, and my role, in addition to my responsibilities in Detroit, were as an executive vice president of the parent company for all of those properties. So more and more, I had to delegate, I had to find a deeper bench in order to make sure that Detroit continued to grow, because Detroit was one of the cash cows. It was one of the engines, you know, that helped the whole company move forward, as was Baltimore. And that changed when my partner unexpectedly died in 1996 at age 57. And his family ended up looking to sell all or parts of the company. And about 20 years ago, I was able, with a lead investor, to buy the Detroit Jewish News and the Atlanta Jewish Times from the family of my former partner.
Growing up, did you ever think you would be a business owner?
Well, as a matter of fact, no. And in part because the primary model for owning a business was my father and his dry goods store. Mm. And my father was a slave to his store. And it was, you know, partially how he ran it, partially it was a mindset, et cetera, et cetera. So growing up, what I saw was somebody who wasn't happy or excited about owning a business or running a store, but rather it was a reason why he couldn't be more involved with family on basic things like going to a baseball game that you're playing in Little League, or going to a concert, or even taking a vacation, which we took one long weekend to Cape Cod as a child, and that was it.
You mentioned earlier how so much of what excited you about journalism was really writing the story, putting it out, knowing people were seeing it, having this impact and being able to affect change. And I'm wondering what that looked like when you were on the management side of things. So you weren't necessarily the one writing the story, but obviously you were, you know, doing something to get it seen.
As the publisher, as the executive editor, it's setting the broader editorial vision, mm-hmm, for what we do, what we cover, what we don't cover, how we cover things, coming up with, you know, making sure that we are reflecting diverse points of view, making sure, you know, that our information is unique and unsubstitutable, making sure that we're trusted, you know, making sure that whatever we do at the end of the day, it's about Jewish survival. So we're an advocacy publication. We advocate for the survival of the Jewish people. And within that framework, you have people on the left and on the right, religious, secular, young, old, who have a vast range of different points of view on how to do that. But that was really that role at that level. You know, I would be writing columns periodically. I'd be writing unsigned editorials on behalf of the publication overall fairly regularly, but it was mostly setting the editorial tone. It's a responsibility, you know, to be serving a community, whether it's secular or Jewish. Added responsibility with Jewish, because there are truly, you know, 50 opinions from five people, and managing that, you know, without offending them all. Occasionally you'll offend a few, of course, every day probably.
And how many years have you been with the Detroit Jewish News?
34 years.
How do you stay motivated to go every single day for 34 years?
Every day in this business, there's news, you know? And you gotta, either it comes to you or you have to go find it. So no one day is the same as the next. The mechanics may be the same, but the content is different. It's not like you're, again, stamping out a widget and you're making 5,000 widgets a week or whatever, and every widget has to be the exact to the 1/1000th of an inch or whatever. Every day, every week, it's a different set of content. So that's important. I think the other thing to recognize, though, is, you know, when it's time to move on. So, you know, for me in the industry that we're in, there's been dramatic changes in general. Jewish journalism is impacted the way everybody else is. As an independent for-profit business, the model which is built traditionally around print advertising revenue is not a sustainable model. And in fact, Google and Facebook today control about 85% of all digital advertising globally. And whatever is left is for everybody else. So that is not a fun growth trajectory. It's more, how do you manage decline? And at the same time, there's more and more demand for the information we have digitally. And the economics of providing that are very, very different than print. Because for the most part, unless you're the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post, people aren't really paying much for a subscription or the quantity of subscriptions or memberships, digital memberships. So we're in the final stages of converting the Jewish News into a nonprofit where the community takes on the ownership of it. And the community through grants and through individual giving, et cetera, helps to make sure that the Jewish News serves the community, because the traditional for-profit model can't do that for us and frankly for most other secular newspapers either. So that's when you know it's time, regardless of your passion, to, you know, do the handoff, to say, you know what, we've preserved the history of the community. We've set up a foundation to be the recipient of the Detroit Jewish News. So my role in that is no longer, or will no longer be, as publisher of the Jewish News, or editor, for that matter, of the Jewish News, as it shouldn't be my role. We have young, you know, people more digitally savvy, but also journalistically talented, who are in those kinds of roles right now. And my role, you know, is more likely to be in an advisory or consulting capacity. You can be passionate or care about what you do, but up to a point, you have to make sure you're not being selfish about it. So there are people who might say, well, as long as I care, as long as I'm passionate, I'm not taking my hands off the steering wheel. I don't care where the car is heading. I don't care if I can't even drive anymore. I want my hands on the steering wheel because that's my passion, is to steer this car. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of times what's important is, even if you're passionate, you all have to overlay it with what are the benefits of your passion to those around you and to the organization or business you're in. And if they don't align, then you need to get your hands off the wheel.
I know at a certain point you started getting really involved in other communities, bridge building between the Jewish community and the African-American community or the Chaldean community, and just other opportunities, the Civil Rights Commission of the state of Michigan, Detroit Public Television. And I'm just wondering, where you were kind of in this Jewish media world for so long, what made you start to put your feelers elsewhere and take time out of your busy schedule to get involved in various other causes and organizations?
Yeah. Well, part of it is looking for personal and professional growth. So one way that I find that I get that is by being involved outside of the bubble, if the bubble is the Jewish community. You know, to sit on a board like Detroit Public Television, the caliber of people and their business experience, their life experience, philanthropic experience, in many cases is different from what you find within the Jewish community. Being on the Detroit Police Athletic League board brings me into direct contact with people who in my normal course of the day, I'm not coming into contact with. It's people who are among the 1,800, African-American men, primarily volunteers, who are coaching teams, but who are also role models for many children who don't have father figures in their lives. It's facilitating, especially these days, community and police interaction and relationships that hopefully can minimize the kinds of things that we've seen, in Minneapolis or Atlanta or Ferguson or Baltimore, et cetera, et cetera. So part of what I see my role and what it's been is how to help the Jewish community, sometimes kicking and screaming figuratively, out of its bubble, out of its comfort zone, out of, well, we're doing okay, and we have a great federation that raises lots of money for Jewish causes, but there are people around us who aren't beneficiaries of the Jewish community's charitable giving or volunteer capabilities. Part of what I think was important is, how do we get some of our best and brightest leaders to also be on boards outside of the Jewish community, instead of always being stocked for Federation or Jewish Community Centers or Jewish Family Services, et cetera. But part of what I felt part of my role was how to take our community beyond its comfort zone, and at the same time, it would require me to become engaged and involved in areas that would be out of my comfort zone as well.
Is there anything you would have done differently?
Boy, is there anything I would have done differently? You know what? It's really hard to say. There's the old saying, on the one hand, that hindsight is 20/20. Should I have been a lawyer or an accountant? I don't think so. Should I have come to Detroit? People, when I came to Detroit from the Baltimore Sun, they were like saying, well, kiss your career goodbye. You're going from a major, well-known national newspaper to, an advocacy newspaper that serves Jews. That's a step backward, Do I regret that? No. Do I wish that the growth plans that I had in mind, back in the 1990s, and especially after buying Detroit and Atlanta, could have led to a global Jewish media entity? I do. I realize in hindsight that that was an example of stretching and having a vision and a plan, but not having the financial resources or the talent, not my own talent alone, but just not having the depth of talent to make that all happen. So except for a couple of things that we were able to do, most of our attempts at growth were not successful. It's not a regret as much as, I would have been much more focused with my efforts instead of going out and trying to build a massive company with very little room for error.
Looking back, how do you feel about what you've done with your life and what's next?
Well, you know, one of the things, you know, and this is a particularly opportune time, you know, to kind of deal with that because, you know, as I had mentioned earlier, the Jewish News is in the process of transitioning to a nonprofit. My role in that will be different. And my goal is to be supportive and helpful, and hopefully everything will close properly, but to move beyond the Jewish News. So what I'm looking at is this is an opportunity to grow and not to do it in the field that I've been in necessarily for 50 years. So I guess the message would be, on the one hand, I feel that I've achieved about as much as I could have hoped to achieve, maybe more so. You know, this year I was inducted into the Michigan Journalism Hall of Fame, which is a very nice honor for a career here. But at the same time, I'm ready for another opportunity or challenge. And I don't mean that in the context of work, but there are other passions that I want to pursue or explore that don't relate specifically to I've got to wake up every morning and be passionate about what I'm doing or else I'm doing the wrong thing. I want to move to something that at this stage of my life maybe has me, you know, have more opportunity to just be myself and not always be on guard. Because in this Jewish community, like most, you're working 24/7 and it's a constant balancing act because people in general view you as a public figure, don't respect your privacy or even give you the opportunity to have your own life. So one thing on a go forward and something to keep in mind as well is, you know, as you pursue a passion, you know, make sure you keep tabs on your work-life balance. And especially if you get to a point where you have an opportunity to move on to another chapter in your life, you know, to make sure that you're keeping all of those things in their proper proportion.
You've always been a role model to me and inspirational, and your work ethic and your passion, and obviously people nagging you all the time. I know you've put up with a lot of really difficult challenges from people to the changes of the news industry and communication and everything going digital. And I just think that you are a big inspiration to me, and you definitely did a shit ton with your life so far. And I can't wait to see what you do next. And I'm really excited for you. And you have to go to your meeting. Thank you. Love you. Bye.